From Ike to Mao and Beyond, My Journey from Mainstream America to Revolutionary Communist, a memoir by Bob Avakian, as read by the author. Chapter 1, Mom and Dad. I was born on March 7, 1943 in Washington, D.C. My mother used to joke that I was almost born on the bridge over the Potomac River, because we lived in Virginia, but the hospital was in D.C. All of a sudden, contractions had started, but she was holding me in until we got to the hospital. So I was actually born in Washington, D.C., but lived my first 3 years in Arlington, Virginia, across the Potomac. My mother, Ruth, was originally from Berkeley, and my dad, Spurgeon, was originally from Fresno, California. My father had become a lawyer by then and had gotten a job working for the Justice Department as a tax evasion prosecutor. This was the time of World War II, and he had wanted to join the Navy but was too short, so he ended up working for the government as a civilian, and that's what we were doing in Washington, D.C. My older sister, Marjorie, was 3 years old at the time I was born. Armenia to Fresno to Berkeley. My dad went to Fresno State for his undergraduate college and then went to law school at Bolt Hall in Berkeley. He specialized in tax law, and that's how he ended up working for the IRS. He'd gotten a lot of offers for jobs from private firms if he would change his name so it didn't sound Armenian, but he refused to do that, both out of pride and because it just seemed unprincipled and unjust for him to have to change his name and hide his family identity and nationality. My dad's parents emigrated from Armenia before the big massacre of 1.5 million Armenians by the Turkish authorities in World War I. Even before the war, the Turkish government had carried out and encouraged brutal pogroms against Armenians for many years. My grandmother's and grandfather's families had both suffered from that, and they had left Armenia and come to the U.S. when my grandparents were young, where they met each other and married. So my father was born in the U.S. in Fresno, where his parents' families had settled as farmers because the climate and the kind of crops you could grow were similar to Armenia. By the time I was a kid, my grandparents' farm was very small, and they sort of eked out an existence with that, plus the income that my grandfather earned by washing windows. They grew grapes, walnuts, almonds, maybe a few orange trees, apricots, things like that. The grapes would have taken the most acreage, but the whole farm was only 9 acres. My dad worked on the farm when he was growing up, as did his two brothers. Later, when he didn't have to do it for economic reasons any longer, the kind of things that he'd done as a farm kid became a sort of recreation for him. My dad's older brother, Beecher, went to Stanford for a year, and I'm pretty sure it was on a scholarship because his family didn't have money. But Beecher only lasted 1 year at Stanford, and I think it was both because he felt a little guilty about being a burden on the family. Even though he had a scholarship, they still had to contribute to supporting him. And from what my father told me, maybe Beecher was not all that comfortable at Stanford, which was a completely different environment for him. He came back to Fresno and opened a small business as an auto mechanic. And my father's younger brother, Herbie, never did go to college. So my father was the only one in his family who finished college. This was all during the Great Depression of the 1930s, and nobody, at least nobody in my dad's circles, had a lot of money. He went to Fresno State because he could live at home, and then he went on to Berkeley for law school. When I was growing up, we would often go to Fresno to be with my father's relatives for Thanksgiving, and then we'd stay at home for Christmas, and a lot of my mom's relatives would come over for that. The main thing I remember about holidays with my dad's relatives, to be honest, is a lot of the food. I remember the smell of my grandfather barbecuing shish kebab on the farm. And there would be chickens running around, and sometimes my grandmother would disappear and then come back a little bit later with a chicken for dinner. I guess she was very adept at wringing their necks, plucking the feathers, skinning them, and getting them all prepared. And we never saw it. I just knew that she made delicious chicken. They'd have Armenian pilav, which was very rich with butter, and I would just pile the pilav on top of this chicken, and then I'd put my fork down through the pilav, and the chicken was so tender it would just fall away from the bone when my fork got to it. A lot of the relatives in Fresno spoke Armenian, at least among themselves, more than they spoke English. My father spoke Armenian, especially to his parents and to other Armenians, when they were in that cultural scene. I learned just a few phrases from being around my father, but neither I nor my two sisters really learned how to speak the language. Yet we did imbibe, so to speak, some of the culture just from being around. It wasn't just the food. My grandparents were very good-hearted, generous people, and some of my other Armenian relatives were as well. But many of them were also petty property owners and proprietors, with the corresponding outlook. So it was a very contradictory kind of relationship. I was fond of them because they were relatives, and many of them were very kind on a personal level. But at the same time, many were very narrow-minded and conservative, or even reactionary, on a lot of social and political issues. And from a very early age, because I was raised differently than that, there was a lot of tension, which sometimes broke out kind of sharply. Fresno was an extremely segregated city, with a freeway through the center of town serving as a great divide. On one side of the freeway lived all the white people, and essentially only white people lived there. Ironically, the Armenians, who were not actually European in origin, in the context of America, were assimilated as white people, even though they faced some discrimination. By the time I was growing up, if you were Armenian, you were accepted among the white people by and large, somewhat the way other immigrants, like Italians, might have gone through some discrimination, but finally got accepted as being white. The blacks and the Latinos and Asians lived on the other side of the freeway in Fresno, where the conditions were markedly and dramatically much worse. And none of my Fresno relatives ever ventured, at least if they could help it, across the freeway. So this was emblematic and representative of a lot of the conflict that came up. For these reasons, I have acutely contradictory feelings about Fresno and my Armenian relatives. My dad was very aware of the discrimination against Armenians, and this had a big effect on how he looked at things more broadly. He ended up setting up his own practice, and practiced law with a couple of partners, partly because he couldn't get hired by these other firms, even though, as I said, many of them offered him jobs if he would change his name. I remember his telling a story about when he was on the college debating team. They were traveling to a debate in Oregon, I think, and they went to the house of one of the debating team members for dinner before the debate. So, as people do when they are being hospitable, the family was lavishing a lot of food on the team, and it got to a certain point where the debating team guys were saying, "No, we're full. Thank you very much." And the hosts were saying, "Come on, eat, eat. Don't be a starving Armenian." Then all the members of the debating team got this look on their faces, and the parents realized they must have committed a faux pas, and then someone told them what the deal was with my dad. Those kinds of incidents stamped the question of discrimination very acutely into my father's consciousness. Besides learning about this directly from him, I've seen interviews that he's done or speeches that he's given where he has talked about the big impact this had on him and how it made him very acutely aware of the whole question of discrimination and the injustice of it. This would carry over importantly into his life when the struggle around civil rights and the oppression of black people broke open in American society in a big way in the 1950s and 60s. I don't have many memories of my very early childhood. I remember running around what seemed like a huge courtyard when I was maybe 2 years old. I went back and saw it as a teenager, and it turned out to be a tiny little space, but at the time, it seemed pretty big to me. And I can remember watching my dad play softball. But one very strong memory I do have is when my dad got polio and was paralyzed. This was pretty traumatic for me, to see someone so strong in my life in such suffering. On top of this, a lot of the other parents didn't want their kids to play with me or my sister anymore. My mother nursed my dad back to health while she was pregnant with my younger sister, and she had to keep two boisterous kids indoors because other parents didn't want to risk getting their kids exposed to polio. And she had to keep us quiet on top of that, since my dad couldn't take too much noise. My dad was determined to regain his ability to walk and even to run and to play sports. He had always been a sports fanatic. He was really into tennis, but he was a fanatic about sports in general, And I remember being told later that part of the reason he was so determined to walk again was to teach me how to play sports. I recall a story that my parents used to tell all the time, very fondly, about how one day he was doing these exercises where he was just trying to lift his leg a little bit off the bed, and my mom was in the other room, and he called her, "Ruthie, Ruthie, come here, come here. I lifted it, I lifted it." She came running in, and his leg was just microscopically off the bed. But he was so excited, because that was the first time since he got polio that he'd been able to lift his leg on his own. It took him quite a while to get back to walking, but eventually, with a lot of determination and help from my mom, he got back all of his abilities to do things, though his stomach muscles were permanently weakened. Compassionate and determined. My mother was both very compassionate and generous on the one hand, and at the same time, very determined if she made up her mind about something. And this was very important in my dad's recovery from polio. There was no other way for my father to recover other than for her to essentially nurse him back to health and assist him with his exercises, what today would be called physical therapy. I don't remember exactly how long a period that was. It wasn't years, but it was months. My parents were very fond of each other and very good to each other. They were married for over 60 years. But there was also this sort of classical post-World War II division of labor where mainly my mom took care of the kids and my dad worked. I can remember, for example, when my younger sister, Mary Lou, was born just before we left Washington, D.C. in 1946. My older sister and I both had the chicken pox while my mom was in the hospital having my sister. Then my dad had to go out of town for work, so they had to get a babysitter. At that point, my sister and I were at the totally unmanageable stage of just getting over the chicken pox, and the babysitter could only take a few hours of us before she was calling up my dad and threatening to quit right in the middle of all this. Eventually, as I recall, my dad prevailed on her to stay, but that gives you a feel for how it was in those days, with the classical post-World War II division of labor. My mother's family name was Welch, and she came from a long line of families from Great Britain, both her mother's and her father's, and that's a very different background than my dad's. My mother was much more deeply religious than my father, but a lot of the religious side of her was his spirit of Christian giving and the golden rule and doing for the less fortunate. Even some of the things that could have been tokenistic were more than that with my mom. We used to have sacrifice night on Sundays during Lent, when instead of eating a regular meal, we would have a very sparse meal and not eat anything for the rest of the night. Then we would take the money that we would have spent on having a regular meal and contribute it to a church charity. There were two things that were supposed to be accomplished with this. One purpose was to send the money to the charity, but at least as importantly, especially to my mom, was that you were experiencing what it was like not to just be able to go to the cupboard and eat what you wanted to eat. Now, obviously, we weren't sharing the conditions of the oppressed or of the really impoverished people in the world. But to my mom, it was more than just a tokenistic thing. To be honest, some of us kids kind of dreaded it, but it also had a good effect on us, even though it was in the context of Christian charity and so on. That was my mom. She wasn't self-effacing, but she was very self-sacrificing and generous. Now, my parents weren't just together for over 60 years. They were extremely fond of each other the whole time. This was something that I always recognized and appreciated. And in particular with my mom, I always recognized and appreciated her compassion and generosity and self-sacrificing qualities. But growing up as a boy in the 40s and 50s, in the more middle-class stratum that I was from, in a lot of ways I kind of took my mother for granted. You know, she was always there. She was always supportive. She was always helpful. She was always so compassionate and sympathetic. And she was always sacrificing for other people in the family or for other people beyond the family. But as an adult, I actually learned a lot of things about my mother and learned to appreciate her much more fully than I did as a kid. For instance, when she was still pretty young, back in the 1930s, she drove her family across the country at one point, which was not that common a thing for a woman to do then. Another time, when she was teaching high school, there was one student there who needed to get certain credits for college. In particular, she needed to take Latin, but there was no Latin class there. So just for this girl's benefit, my mom arranged to teach Latin. But even more than those incidents, I've come to see how I've taken many of her values and made them my own. Also, my mother had a great love of the outdoors that she'd gotten from her family, in particular her father. She liked taking us to the mountains and out into nature, to all these beautiful places that I learned to love. One time, my younger sister Mary Lou and myself and my parents had gone up into the mountains, and on our way back home, we had to go through the little dreary town of Merced, just a little ways from Fresno. It was getting to be about lunchtime, and Merced was about an hour away, and my mother was very determined that we were going to eat in the beautiful setting of the mountains. But the rest of us wanted to have ice cream or something down in Merced. Finally, after a long discussion, we decided to have a vote, and my father ended up voting with us two kids to eat in Merced. This infuriated my mom, and looking back on it, with good reason. Of course, she had the right stand, yet she didn't win out. But in order to try to win, at one point, when we said we were ready to vote on it, she said, "Okay, let's have a vote now. Who wants to eat lunch up in the mountains by a beautiful rippling stream?" She said this in a very lilting and appealing voice. "And," she continued, "who wants to eat in hot old Merced?" She said the latter with such disdain that you would have thought we were going to be eating in a garbage dump. Unfortunately, even her way of stacking the argument didn't lead her to winning out in that case, although it did become a sort of family metaphor for indicating a strong preference while posing as neutral. She was completely right, of course, and now I would have no hesitation to side with her if she were here. But that was my mom. It shows both her determination and her love for nature. I took that in from her, and it's been with me ever since. My dad grew up on a farm, and later on he very much loved a home that my parents had in the Santa Cruz Mountains. But as far as roughing it, that wasn't really his thing so much. As I said, my dad grew up in very modest circumstances, so it wasn't that he was spoiled, but roughing it in nature wasn't his idea of an ideal vacation, the way it was for my mom. She often prevailed in that, for which I was very glad. My parents met in Berkeley. My mom was a student at Cal, which was also somewhat unusual for a woman at that time. And then because of the Depression and because my dad was still in law school, they couldn't afford to get married. So they were engaged for 3 years before they got married. And during that time, after she graduated from Cal and after a year of looking for work, my mom got a job teaching school in a small town, a couple of hours from Berkeley. She taught high school there for 2 years. She could not say that she was engaged while she was teaching, because then they would think she would leave once she was married and would fire her. So she had to hide the fact that she was engaged. And a number of the guys who were teaching at the school were trying to ask her out. It was a very awkward thing. But after a couple of years when my dad finished law school, my mom and dad got married. While my parents were from different backgrounds, neither of their families resisted their marriage. Despite a lot of insularity among the Armenian relatives, my father's parents felt the important thing was what kind of person you marry, not whether they were an Armenian. My mother was pretty readily accepted, both because of the attitude of my father's parents, but also because she was a very likable person. And my mother learned how to cook some of the Armenian foods and picked up some of the other cultural things. Beyond that, my father would not have put up with any crap. So the combination of all that meant that she got accepted pretty quickly. I'm not aware of friction from my mother's parents toward my dad. They were nice people generally, although they too were pretty conservative in a lot of ways. And also, to be honest, my father, having graduated from law school, was someone who had a certain amount of stature when my parents got married. Despite the fairly conservative atmosphere in which she was raised, my mother was very far from being narrow and exclusive in how she related to people. If she came in contact with you, unless you did something to really turn her off or to make her think that you were a bad person, she would welcome and embrace you, and that would last through a lifetime. Besides things like the Sunday sacrifice night meal, my parents, mostly on my mother's initiative, would do other Christian charity things, like in that Jack Nicholson movie about Schmidt, where he adopts a kid from Africa and sends money. But they not only paid a certain amount of money, They took an active interest. They corresponded. They actually tried to go and visit some of the kids or even the people as grown-ups with whom they had had this kind of relationship. My mother had a very big heart and very big arms, if you want to put it that way. She embraced a lot of people in her lifetime. You really had to do something to get her not to like you. She was not the kind of person who would reject people out of hand or for superficial reasons. I remember when I was about 4 or 5 years old, and somehow from the kids that I was playing with, I picked up this racist variation on a nursery rhyme. So I was saying, "Eeny, meeny, miny, moe, catch a nigger by the toe." I didn't even know what nigger meant. I just heard other kids saying this. And she stopped me and said, "You know, that's not very nice. That's not a nice word." And she explained to me further, the way you could to a 4 or 5 year old, why that wasn't a good thing to say. That's one of those things that stayed with me. I'm not sure exactly what the influences on my mom were in that way, but I do remember that very dramatically. It's one of those things that, even as a kid, makes you stop in your tracks. She didn't come down on me in a heavy way. She just calmly explained to me that this was not a nice thing to say and why it wasn't a good thing to say. That was very typical of my mother, and it obviously made a lasting impression on me. One thing I learned from my mother is to look at people all-sidedly, to see their different qualities and not just dismiss them because of certain negative or superficial qualities. And I also learned from my mother what kind of person to be yourself, to try to be giving and outgoing and compassionate and generous and not narrow and petty. I think that's one of the main influences my mother had on me.